Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to a brand new Arsblog Arscast right here on arsblog.com. How's it going? How are you? How are you feeling? How's everything hanging? Hopefully to the good side. It was Groundhog Day this week. Did you see that? The Groundhog decided that we were going to get 6 more weeks of winter. And I thought, you little fucking prick. As if that's what anybody needs right now. 6 more weeks of winter, come on. Shit is weird enough as it is without you adding to the greyness and the gloominess with more winter. I mean, there is, just generally speaking, a big Groundhog Day element to life at the moment. And I hope wherever you are, you're dealing okay with it. I know it's more applicable to some people in some countries than it is to others. But, you know, it is something we're all having to deal with in one way or another. And I hope you're doing okay with it. I have to say, this week, I don't want to say I'm struggling with it, because that sounds just maybe a little bit too melodramatic. I realize that in the grand scheme of things, I'm pretty lucky when it comes right down to it. There are a lot of people in worse situations than I'm in, and I can work, and, you know, I'm at home, and, you know, it's not the greatest sacrifice in the world, is it, just to stay at home? But there are also times where you just like to go somewhere, no? Do something. We're restricted to within 5 kilometers of our home, and, you know, nothing is open in terms of, you know, social activities. And this week, I think for the first time really since all this started, I had a real panging for just going to the pub and having a couple of pints and just sitting and people watching and talking and, you know, having a chat with the barman or whatever it might be, just to get out of the house and have a little bit of a change of scenery and what have you. And I think in some ways, you know, the football is contributing to this sense of repetitiousness or whatever it might be, because generally speaking, when football was on, you could kind of tell what day of the week it was. You know, it was usually weekends. I know we had midweek fixtures and everything else, but there just seems to be a round of fixtures every day, or a game every day at least, and it kind of blurs the, I don't know how to quite describe it, in the sense that in my mind's eye, I have a visualization of a week and how it's constructed, and it's all blurred. It's all smooshed together now, and the days are kind of the same, and you get up and you have breakfast and you walk the dogs and you do more work and you walk the dogs and then blah, 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 and you walk the dogs. And, you know, you don't have the weekend to look forward to. There's nothing to bookend your week. Like every Friday evening, I used to have a game of five-a-side at 7 o'clock, and it was a brilliant way just to sort of put to bed the Monday to Friday-ness of the week. You knew when you were playing football on a Friday, you know, that was the end of that, you know, nominal working week. Of course, when you're working with football, you're working at weekends very often, and I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but, you know, just in terms of the Monday to Friday of life, you had these markers, and they're now gone. For me, anyway. So it's weird, and it's been a bit strange this week. I feel like this week more than any other week in the pandemic that it has kind of got to me or got on top of me or whatever. And I don't mean to say that I'm having a really hard time or anything like that. I don't want to belittle or demean the genuine struggles that many people are going through, but I can't help longing for precedented times. Do you know what I mean? It's been unprecedented, as everyone says in their emails, and surreal and weird. And I would like us, and I hope that we get there very soon,
to get back to precedented times, when we kind of know what the fuck is going on and what we can do and where we can go and everything else. So wherever you are, whatever you're doing, however you're doing it, I hope you're feeling okay. It's not getting too difficult for you guys out there. As ever, thank you for being here, and thank you for, you know, thank you for being along during this entire period, because for me, as much as anything, Arsblog has been this way of keeping myself grounded and structured in many ways. So, you know, the benefits to me of doing all the stuff that we do here on the site are considerable. So it wouldn't be worth too much without all of you guys. So thank you very much indeed. Whew, okay. Yeah. I'm going to leave that in, because normally what happens is I put the mic up, I start talking, I'm not quite sure where it's going to go, and that just kind of came out. So I'm going to leave it there. But we are obviously going to talk a lot of football. There's a lot going on. We had a midweek defeat to Wolves in which there were negatives, in which there were a lot of positives as well. So we're going to talk about where we are, how we might cope with this unbeaten run, looking ahead to Aston Villa and all the rest. So with me to do that, I'm delighted to welcome back to the show from Goal, it's Charles Watts. Hi, Charles.
Hello, mate. How are you doing? Good to speak to you again.
And you. Let's start with Wolves. And, you know, I think there was a common theme going around after the game in that a lot of people felt really frustrated and annoyed by what had happened, but not in the typical way that we've had this season, in that, like, oh, Arsenal have lost again, we've been rubbish. There was a very sort of familiar feeling of, like, oh, this is, I like being pissed off by a result, because we actually played well and there was a lot to like about the first 45 minutes, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, obviously losing an unbeaten record, as short as it was, is never good. But there were certainly a lot of positives for Mikel Arteta to take from that first 46 and a half minutes, more or less.
Yeah, there were. It was absolutely the best performance of the season, I think, First half. I had the tweet lined up, ready to hit publish for the halftime whistle as soon as Bert Leno took the goal kick. I was waiting to publish it, and, you know, just saying best 45 minutes of the season. It was really exciting to see how they played, and how you've just seen the progress week in, week out since Boxing Day, and it all seemed to culminate in that first 45 minutes, which I just thought was fantastic. And then obviously what happened and it all changed. And but there was that feeling afterwards of, I mean, I was really frustrated at what happened, and it was more a case of, not just for the red card and for the penalty, but the fact that it was a game where everything was looking so good, and then suddenly it all went pear-shaped. And it was just really frustrating, because you just could see how they were on it, and you could see how the players were gutted after. I looked at Granit Xhaka at full-time, and honestly, he looked like he'd lost a World Cup final. You could see how much it affected him, and Bukayo Saka as well, because they knew how well it was going, how well they were playing, and to lose that game and come away with nothing was just such a blow. But I do think that there's so many positives to take. I asked Mikel afterwards in a press conference, and he agreed. And, you know, it wasn't that feeling of, like you said before Christmas, where you're just coming away from another away game or home game back then, thinking, oh, it's another defeat, and, you know, we're looking terrible. It was the exact polar opposite for me. And I just hope that it's not going to knock confidence. And I don't think it will do, because I think you can take so much from that. The players can take much from that. You can almost channel the frustration as well and turn it into a good thing. So I don't think it will affect them too much, and they will certainly be at Colney this week feeling fairly good about themselves despite losing.
Yeah, it is different, isn't it? When you're going through that bad run, the issue is, like, how do we get out of it? How do we win games? You know, it becomes not a vicious circle, but it's a self-perpetuating thing that you struggle and you continue to struggle and you don't know how you're going to get out of it. Whereas on this occasion, you just say, well, look, do what you did in the first 45 minutes. You know, maybe keep switched on until the halftime whistle goes. That's maybe a lapse of concentration very slightly. But in terms of the way Arsenal were playing, the way they were playing football, chances creating, how dominant they were in the game. You know, people talk about Wolves as this really, you know, our record against them in recent times hasn't been great, but they talk about Wolves as being a very difficult team to play against. And I know they themselves are going through a particularly bad run of form, and you know, it ended the other night with a win. But, you know, to be that good against a team who many people have said are a difficult team to play against, similarly Southampton, you know, in the last the game, obviously sandwiched between that was the Manchester United game. you know, there are real green shoots. There are signs of what Arteta is doing on the training ground, transmitting itself to the pitch and in the performances, because he's always talked about working hard and working harder and doing this, doing that and the other, and it has always come off. But now it certainly is. So I think it might be easier for the players and for the manager to compartmentalize this as a blip, put it in a box and move on.
Yeah, I think they do. And speaking of Mikel this morning at his press conference, you got the sense that's how he is viewing it. You know, he looked back on it, basically, that we've got to move on now. It's done and dusted. Yes, we're frustrated. Yes, we kind of feel a little bit hard done by in terms of how the decisions went. But you've got to put that to one side now and focus on Saturday. And you've got a very tough game on Saturday against a Villa side who, you know, turned up at the Emirates and rolled Arsenal over 3-0 not too long ago. So you can't afford to feel sorry for yourself for too long, as much as we've all probably had that feeling since Tuesday night. And everyone's got their own opinion on what happened and how it happened. But now that is, it's consigned history, isn't it? And you've got to focus on Saturday and continuing that good run of form that Arsenal were on prior to Tuesday night and showed on Tuesday night that they're playing that sort of style of football. So there's a lot to feel good about, I think. And I just feel it's beginning to feel now that Arteta's vision is starting to take shape. I mean, we're nowhere near there yet, but I think the January window is massive for him, getting those players out and away from the squad and away from Colney is huge. And that was always going to be the focus in January, was to do that, because I think everyone knew behind the scenes how important it was to get those players out now rather than wait until the summer. And they've done that. And I think that's massive for Mikel and his squad management and just the general mood around the place. And it's just beginning to feel like more like his squad now. And I think he sort of looked two transfer windows down the line and I can just see where we're going to be there. And you can see the football they're starting to play now. He's settled on the formation at last. It's 4-2-3-1.
Yeah.
He feels like it's here to stay at the moment. There's not going to be chopping and changing. There's no back five, you know, back 4-3-3, anything like that. And
they
just look like a settled team now. And I think the move over for Pepe to the left has been really interesting. And I thought Tuesday night was the best I've seen him play, in, not just in terms of the goal, but just in terms of working for the team and winning the ball back. And, you know, there's a hunger about him that I'm not sure I've really seen from Pepe since he's arrived. We've always seen flashes of quality time to time, but you know, he seems to have got the bit between his teeth now. And you know, Saka's just getting better by the game.
Yeah,
and Partey and Xhaka are looking better and better in the central midfield. You know, that's a partnership that's building, and defensively they've been solid. So there's lots to feel good about.
Let's talk about Pepe then for a minute, because he's down my list, but seeing as we're on him, we might as well talk about him. And Arteta was pretty complimentary about him today in his press conference when he was talking about the performances, and not just what he was contributing from an attacking perspective, but obviously, you know, what he wants from players all over the pitch is a really important part of what this manager expects in terms of performance levels. Like, you know, if you're producing at one end and you're not necessarily doing it at the other end, you're going to have a problem. How much do you think in some ways Arsenal have been the architects of what has been up to now a relatively disappointing season for Nicolas Pepe, in that towards the end of last season he really looked like he clicked in terms of what Arteta wants. You know, the performance in the FA Cup final, as we reference all the time, was absolutely fantastic. It was probably his most complete performance as an Arsenal player, and it felt towards the end of the season that he had given himself a platform on which to build in the upcoming season. And then we go out, and obviously I'm not here to talk about Willian, because I think everybody has said as much as needs to be said about Willian at this moment in time. But, you know, the way that we, in some ways, perhaps derail Pepe by bringing in Willian, playing him consistently in his position, even when Willian wasn't playing that well, you know, it's got to be a bit of a dent to his confidence. Now, obviously, the player himself, when he plays, is the master of what he can do on the pitch. At the same time, there are all these other factors with professional players. How valued do they feel? How much confidence do they feel from the coach when they go onto the pitch? You know, you can have a brilliant player who's made to feel that small by a coach who doesn't rate him, you know? So if you're a good player and you don't feel that, it can become a bit of a struggle. And I think Pepe struggles in some way this season. He has to own some of it, of course, but I think Arsenal and the way they've managed his situation have to maybe hold their hands up and say it wasn't the best way to to get what you wanted from Pepe, if that's what it was, whether it was like a competition thing, you know, to try and book him up, I don't quite know.
No, I agree. I think the start of the season was not a good thing for Pepe. And like you said, he ended last year so well. The cup final was, you know, he's up to Tuesday night. I think it was his best performance for Arsenal, although that was over 90 minutes. And to then suddenly lose your place in the team at the starting 11, right at the start of the season to a new signing, it felt a bit harsh. And that was absolutely, no matter who you are, that's going to knock your confidence. And Pepe is known as, you know, he's not the most sort of expressive kind of character behind the scenes. He's quite a quiet guy. He's very well liked, but he's not, you always kind of view him as someone who maybe has confidence issues and things like that. So I think that definitely knocked him out of his stride. There's no doubt about it. And it would to any player, really. And especially when the guy's coming in, taking places and playing well and isn't really producing anything. So that would knock his confidence. And you kind of look at his stats. I mean, even so, his stats are pretty impressive this season. When admittedly, some of those are in the Europa League when you're playing, you know, really poor sides. And Arsenal's opposition in the Europa League this season has been terrible. So you'd hope someone like Pepe would sort of pack his, would, you know, knock up his assists and his goals in those sort of matches. But so I think they did contribute, like I said, to his early struggles. But he needs to do it himself as well, doesn't he? You can't just focus it on that. And him coming in, he got his chance against Leeds, having spent that international break calling for his chance, and he comes on and gets himself sent off the way he did.
Yeah.
That's not going to help him.
No, that's fair point.
It really didn't help him. And to be fair, Arteta actually brought him back in sooner than I thought he was going to after that, because I thought he might be on the naughty step for a fair while after that. And he's actually used him a lot more than I thought he was going to. And it's interesting how the move to the left, though, in recent weeks seems to have brought out more of him. And none of us are really expecting that, because he's so left-footed. He loves to cut inside, get on that left foot. So you kind of feel like moving out to the left wasn't really an option for him. But he's really excelled there. He was great against Southampton. He was fantastic on Tuesday night as well. But it's just work ethic that he's putting in now. The tackling back, winning the ball, you know, his goal, although it was all about his quality and the end product, he started that move by winning it, pressing high, winning it, laying it off to Lacazette, and sort of started it himself. And I think that's what really, really impressed Mikel. And like you said, when under Mikel, it's not just about what you're doing at one end of the pitch, it's about what you're doing all over the pitch and at the other end as well. And if you're not contributing at the back, then you're going to be in real trouble in an Arteta side, and he's certainly doing that now. And it's an interesting one, though, because you've got Aubameyang back now.
Yeah.
Obviously.
That's the question.
Yeah.
I mean, look, from everything that we've learned about Pepe in the 18 months or so that he's been here, it does seem as if, you know, when he's on it, when he's playing well and when he's feeling confident, that's when you need to really give him a run and hope he can establish himself. It's not that he's going to score in every game, but, you know, when you're feeling like part of the team and things are going for you, you've got to stay in it. I mean, I think one of the obvious ways we could bring Aubameyang back into the team is also at centre forward as well. Lacazette looked a little off the pace, didn't he, against Wolves on Tuesday night, whether he was feeling the effects of the United game or the injury or whatever he might have picked up towards the end of the United game. You know, it's not quite as cut and dried as it might have been. Like, Aubameyang's back, Aubameyang's going to play on the left. You know, A, when Pepe's in that form, B, when Saka is in the form he's in on the right, you can't change him from there either. So it becomes maybe not quite an either or, but it's certainly a consideration. If you want to bring Aubameyang back in, you do it for Lacazette rather than Pepe.
Yeah, I don't know. You can't not play Pepe on Saturday. It would send out all the wrong messages. I think if you did that, I think he's absolutely nailed on to start that one. And like you said, if Aubameyang is going to come in, it's going to be in place of Laka. I do worry, though, a little bit with that as well, in terms of, I think I agreed Laka was a little bit off it on Tuesday night. I still think Mikel got it wrong, really, making that substitution at halftime. I'm not sure Laka was the man to come off, because kind of killed the focal point in the attack at that point. And I could see what he was doing and going for pace. And obviously, the fact that Wolves scored 3 minutes later didn't help, and suddenly you're chasing the game. Yeah, you're not level anymore. You're actually chasing it, and that was an issue. But I do worry about Aubameyang leading the line centrally as the sort of central striker. I've not really seen yet evidence that he does that as well as Laka. And
he does it differently, though. I think that's the thing. He does it differently, you know, in that he's get on the end of stuff, whereas Lacazette does tend to... I don't think it's fair to say that Aubameyang can't do those things, but I think, you know, if you're looking for somebody just to drop a little deeper in some of the combination play that we've seen with Smith-Rowe, with Saka, for example, it does seem to be a little more in Lacazette's wheelhouse. So it does maybe precipitate a slight change in the way you might attack.
Yeah. I just still think we'll see Laka on Saturday. I think Aubameyang, he's probably had one training session, two training sessions out of Wolves, so he's had a couple more now. Maybe you go with Laka one more and then you make that decision after the Villa game, I think. I'd be surprised to see Aubameyang come straight into the starting 11, but it's a nice option to have when you're debating who to play. You know, it's not too long ago that we were sitting here thinking, oh God, who's going to play where? They're all in terrible form, and now suddenly they're all playing well, all in good form. And it was going to be an interesting challenge against Villa, because how are they going to respond to last night's defeat when, you know, West Ham comfortably beat them at Villa Park, and how are they going to respond to it? So it's two teams going into it on the back of disappointing defeats, kind of one on the back of a decent performance and the other on the back of a poor performance. So yeah, it's going to be an interesting game, but it's just a shame that there's probably going to be a very inexperienced goalkeeper in goal for Arsenal, unfortunately. And that is a bit of a concern.
It is, isn't it? I mean, let's go there again, seeing as you brought it up. It's likely to be Alex Runarsson. Mikel Arteta saying that Matt Ryan hasn't even trained. So it strikes me that if Ryan were out there on Saturday against Villa, he's probably had the old needle in the wherever he needs it to get him through a game, which is never ideal, you know? And if a player hasn't trained, he's not sharp, etc., etc. It was interesting, wasn't it, to hear Arteta talk about Runarsson in the sense of, you know, his status in the squad, because people were saying, is it going to be strange that a goalkeeper you've left out of the Europa League squad is now going to be starting a game in the Premier League for you? Obviously, because Bernd Leno is suspended for a game and Matt Ryan is probably injured. And he was saying, well, no, it's not strange. He knew his role when he arrived. And, you know, from what he's saying, it's basically that Runarsson is planned to be the third choice goalkeeper. Yeah. I think he was like an emergency second choice, who they see as, you know, a third choice option as well. I think he said something along the lines of, you know, they had a plan for the goalkeepers that they couldn't quite pull off the plan. Obviously, David Raya from Brentford was the guy that they wanted to bring in to understudy or provide competition to Bernd Leno, however you want to look at that. And Runarsson was going to be a third choice goalkeeper. So, you know, that's kind of where we are with this guy. There aren't too many teams playing their third choice goalkeepers in Premier League games, are there? I'm trying to think of one off the top of my head. I mean, there's the young guy at Liverpool, Quivin Kelleher, who maybe started the season as third choice there and has bumped his way up in the pecking order. But it is going to be a bit of a challenge from a defensive perspective against a good Villa side if Runarsson is in there.
Well, it is. If you're judging it on the performances in Europa League that he's turned out, it is a big concern. To his credit, I thought he actually did well against Wolves.
He did, yeah.
Worried then, especially given it was absolutely lashing it down and it was pretty much the worst conditions you could get for a goalkeeper. And the way he came into the game after, you know, not expecting it, suddenly being thrown in, I was a bit worried. I thought Wolves were going to be taking pot shots from everywhere and testing him out. And they did have a couple, but he coped with it well. One could save his hands, one could save his legs. And so credit to him for that. But I do worry about him in the 90 minutes. From what I've seen from him this season, there's nothing to suggest he really is Arsenal quality. And so that is a little bit of a concern. I suspect they'll do all they can to get Matt Ryan fit. But if it is absolutely impossible, obviously it's going to have to be Alex. And it's a big game for him. It is odd coming in the week that you've been left out of the Europa League. So that's not exactly the ideal confidence booster, is it, for you? But as Mikel said, I mean, he knew when he came here he was coming as number three. Arsenal didn't mess up, that's a bit harsh, but they didn't get the deal done that they wanted for Raya at Brentford, and they're probably going to have to wait till the summer to try and move on with that one again. And so they've had to go with Runarsson at number two. And they needed to do something in January. I thought it was probably the most essential bit of transfer business they could do was getting an experienced cover for Leno, so they managed to do that. It's just typical Arsenal that once you do that, you get the guy goes and gets himself injured in training, and then Leno gets himself sent off, and suddenly you've got Renison in goal anyway. So yeah, it's classic Arsenal. I feel for Matt Ryan because this might be his only opportunity. He's only here to the end of the season. He's an Arsenal fan. He suddenly he comes. He wants to get a game, and he gets his opportunity and he gets injured as well. So I do feel for Ryan in all of this as well.
Yeah. Do we know exactly what the injury is? I think was it a hip injury or
a hip injury? Yeah, but we don't know exactly how bad it is. But the fact he's not been training doesn't sort of fill you with confidence. Like you say, they might just stick a needle in him and try and get him through. But if you can't feel your hip for 90 minutes, it's not ideal.
No, for sure. For sure. Just finally, on a player perspective, Kieran Tierney's going to be out, it looks like, for the weekend. Were you in any way concerned about the lack of a left back arrival? Arteta said something along the lines of, look, we can't do everything in one window, and they did a lot in this particular window. Obviously most of it was outward, but they did address the goalkeeper situation. They obviously got Martin Odegaard in, which is a fantastic signing. We'll have to wait and see if he starts. But you know, in terms of left back cover, we're a bit light. Kieran Tierney, I think what's interesting about this game against Villa is like you can give it a real push, you know, in terms of the physical effort, because we've got a week until the next fixture, and it's probably the last time for a couple of months that we don't have a midweek fixture, or you're not on that sort of 3-4 day or game every 3 or 4 days kind of schedule. So there is, you know, the possibility to maybe ask people to really give it a bash for this weekend, and then get everyone fit, give them some rest days and lots of massages ahead of what's going to be a busy schedule. But Tierney, I don't think is going to make it this weekend. So, you know, was that a worry, or were you disappointed, or is there, you know, realistically, how much business can you do in 1 month?
Yeah, I mean, they did an awful lot. I think ideally they would have got someone. I think we all kind of know that they're a little bit short of that, especially having let Ainsley go. But they do have, I mean, so I think Cedric's been playing really, really well. I thought he was good on Tuesday night again, especially against a winger like Traore. I thought he did very well playing out of position. And obviously you've got the Saka option, which isn't ideal. You'd rather him playing in the front three. But if you have to, you can play Saka there, and you've still got quality in, to come in up front, you know, on the wide right or wide left to sort of negate the fact that Saka's not there. So I think when you're looking at that, and you've only got 4 months till the end of the season, it's probably just about enough, as long as Tierney isn't, you know, out for 3 or 4 months. So I can understand that if they couldn't find the right deal in January, you're not going to do it just for the sake of it. You're going to think, well, I'll tell you what, we'll wait till the summer and have a proper look. I know they do like Ryan Bertrand at Southampton, and there is interest in him, and he's out of contract in the summer, and Southampton just weren't going to let him go even for whatever money this January, because they just felt he was too important to get him through to the end of the season.
They learned their lesson with Cedric last January.
Yeah. And so I can understand them not doing it. If they want to explore other options in the summer, I'm sure they will, and they will look to bring in some proper cover for Tierney. But I'm not sure we can really criticise them for the work they did in January, because they had so much. I think it was 9 sort of senior transactions done. Mm. Admittedly, most of them were outgoings, but it still takes up an awful amount of your time, and there's just not much money swilling around. And you bring in Ryan, you bring in Odegaard, albeit both on loan. It's pretty decent business, so. Yeah, it's a little bit disappointing. It's probably left them. That's the one area of the squad they may be lacking a little bit, but it's still a decent window. They've done a lot of good work.
Yeah, and I think as James said on the Arscast Extra, they did it, you know, without the addition of that sort of extra piece of the football executive structure, the sort of Husfami role that we know Richard Garlick is going to come in and take over to do that. So there was probably a fairly hefty workload on Edu in particular, and Mikel Arteta to an extent as well.
Yeah, I think Edu's done all right, to be fair to him, because I'm still not sure how I view Edu at the moment.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
I absolutely didn't agree with what he did with the scouting network. I just felt that was really odd. Mm. I still don't quite understand why he's done that. I know he's explained why he done it, but that still doesn't fill me with much confidence, what he had to say about his reasons for doing it.
The proof of that pudding will be in what happens in terms of recruitment in the coming windows, won't it? I mean, you can say it and we can be skeptical, and I think it's reasonable to be skeptical, but we're not going to know one way or the other until such time as they get a couple of windows under their belt and we see, like, who are they identifying? Who are the players that they're bringing in? How are they finding them? What are the profiles of these players? Like, if you're letting all your scouts go and then the best you can come up with, you know, with all due respect to the guy, is Ryan Bertrand, I'm not saying, you know, that's not going to convince anyone, is it? It's really what you do. I mean, maybe in some ways, the Odegaard thing is how will I put this? A sort of tick in Edu's box, if you like, in that was a deal nobody really thought would have been possible for Arsenal in this window, but they made it happen. You know, whatever connections have brought that about, you know, that's impressive in itself.
Yeah, no, that was a good deal to get done. And to do that in January as well, wasn't it? It's a very, very impressive deal to get done. I agree. I think we're going to have to wait a couple more windows to see how it really pans out, because even look at this summer's window, you know, there were still signings that the scouting network that he'd just booted out had set up for him already, really. You know, Thomas Partey and Gabriel, that had all been, you know, those all way down the line. And the people who lost their jobs were really responsible for getting those moves set up and sort of underway, sort of 1-2 years earlier with talks, especially with Thomas Partey. I mean, that went back a long way with Francis. So, it'll be interesting to see how it pans out the next couple of windows. So that's how I started it all off. Although I was a bit sceptical of Edu and what he'd done so far, I thought this January he deserved credit for, because it was a really difficult window for Arsenal to navigate, and there was a lot of tough decisions, quite ruthless decisions to be made. And Arsenal haven't really done that before. They've perhaps not been ruthless when they should have been. And yes, there's only sort of 5-6 months to go, and yes, Arsenal have had to pay players to leave basically at the end of the day. But I felt like they needed to do that, and they went out there and they found a way of doing it. And so I think Edu certainly deserves a lot of credit for the work he put in during January.
How much of what they do from now on has to be informed by the mess that they've just cleaned up, if you like, in terms of contractual situations, players of a certain age being given contracts which make them very difficult to move, you know, because, you know, at the end of the day, regardless of how you view the stature of Arsenal, and certainly the star has fallen a little bit, it is a big club, and in, you know, when it comes to wages, you can offer more than most clubs, generally speaking, which is good when you want to attract players, not so good when you want to move them on, because, you know, who's going to leave a £100,000 a week job to go to a £40,000 a week job? I mean, look, that'd be easy for me and you to decide, but as a professional footballer, that's a consideration. And, you know, contractual situations that they have to deal with come this summer with, you know, the likes of Lacazette, with the likes of Nketiah, guys who are 2 years out. We heard about this when Raul Sanyehi was in charge, and, you know, it was about one of the only things I liked about his time at the club was when he said, you know, we have to make decisions 2 years out on players because we either renew them or we sell them. So between Edu, Arteta, Richard Garlick and the, you know, the owners and whatever executive board structure is there, they have to learn lessons from where we've ended up and what they've had to do, whether that Bank of England loan was there just to pay off these players or deal with other cash flow problems. I can't say 100%, but, you know, you take this loan and then all of a sudden you're paying off Ozil, you're paying off Socrates, you're paying off Mustafi, you know, 2 and 2, et cetera, et cetera. But they have to surely strategize in a big way about how they manage their squad, you know, incomings, outcomings, contracts, who gets an extension, who doesn't, difficult decisions that sometimes you might have to make when it comes to letting a player go, perhaps before they become, I don't want to say useless, but you know what I mean? Think about someone like Robin van Persie, and as an example, he's a player who would have been still very useful to Arsenal for a year and a half. But maybe if you were long-term strategizing, you would say that was the time to sell him because you could raise money for him and reinvest in the squad. Not that it was a popular decision, but just in how you generate funds to reinvest in your squad.
Yeah, and they absolutely have to get better about that. You, it's been terrible for so long. So like, you look back at the players, I mean, the players just they've released now, and you know, Ozil, Socrates, Mustafi, what's that? 100 million on those three players they spent to bring in, all of them gone for free. You know, not, and without, well, I think Ozil signed a new contract during that time, but the others didn't. So in the space of one contract, they've gone from that money spent, 55 million, Socrates and Mustafi, and they've let them go for free, or they paid for them to leave, you know, before they've even, you know, that was on the same contract. So it's been terrible. You go back to Sanchez, Cazorla, Welbeck, I mean,
Wilshere, in, Ramsey. Wilshere,
yeah, for in the last sort of 7-8 years, the players that they've not got any money for is just staggering. And you can't build squads like that. You can't. In no wonder your star's going to fall, like you said at the start, if you run your business like that and you don't bring in more money to invest in a team. And when you're a self-sustainable club like Arsenal and you haven't got someone who's just going to plough their own money in to make these transfers happen, you need to sell as well as you buy. And Arsenal have sold terribly for too long now. But I think the situation of football at the moment is really difficult. I don't think it's just Arsenal who are struggling with this in terms of contracts and things. I think Arsene used to say it all the time, how it was going to get tougher and tougher with players, and more players were just going to see out their contracts, wait, not sign, not commit, and then see what happened at the end. And I think we are seeing that now. So it is very difficult to get these things done. But having said that, you've still got to get better. I thought it was quite interesting when Sanyei said that, the whole, you know, we'll wait, we'll either sell him or sign a new contract with 2 years to go. It was great when he said it, but in truth, they didn't put that into practice at all.
No, they didn't do any of it.
They found it very difficult to actually do that.
Yeah.
And so I think it's going to be very difficult still, and it's going to continue to as more and more footballers decide to wait and see what their options are. But they have to... They've got some big decisions to make, like you said. I think Lacazette's a key one for me. I think you've got to move Lacazette on this summer and reinvest, bring in a younger striker and sort of build again with the forwards, because you can't really give Lacazette a new contract. Now, if you do that, you're basically getting yourself into another situation that we've seen with some of these players. And there's no way that there's better to come from Lacazette. We've seen the best of Lacazette at Arsenal. I think he's only going to go one way from here, really. So. I think you've got to try and find a way of getting some money for him that you can invest in a younger striker who you can kind of try and mould into the player you want, that Arteta wants over the next 2-3 years. I think they will do that as well. The Nketiah situation is an interesting one, because although I've yet to see anything from Eddie to suggest he is going to go on and be a huge success at Arsenal, I think you've got a very valuable asset there, because he's English, he's young, he scores goals, he's scored goals in the Premier League, he's England under 21's top goal scorer. And you look at Ryan Brewster, went for 25 million last summer. So what should Eddie be worth, really? So you kind of got to protect your asset there for me and try and get something done with Eddie, even if it is just with a view to selling him another year down the line. And, you know, it looks like we're going to lose Balogun, which is a shame. And so if you lose Lacazette and you lose Balogun this summer, you're basically looking at your two strikers as Eddie and Orba, and perhaps Martinelli, if you see him as a central striker. So they've got some things they really need to sort out with the forwards. And I think that's got to be one of the most pressing needs this summer. And Guendouzi, you know, there's loads of situations for contracts. He's going to be a year left now. And
Kolasinac,
the player who 5 months into his Arsenal contract, you thought it was probably going to be worth 50, 60 million pounds. And now you're suddenly facing up to the prospect of losing him a couple of years later for next to nothing. And it's a shame how that one's all panned out.
Yeah, they have plenty to do when it comes to the transfer market. But that's the summer, and maybe we're getting ahead of ourselves a little bit here. Just finally, I wanted to talk to you about discipline or indiscipline, however way you want to put it. Since he took over, Mikel Arteta has had 9 red cards. I do think in some ways there's a legacy issue in that I kind of felt like in the Wenger years, Arsenal were an easy club for referees to give red cards to. And I'm not espousing any kind of refereeing conspiracy theories here or anything like that, apart from Mike Riley at Old Trafford for the 50th game, which of course was corrupt, and Robin van Persie at Barcelona. But I don't think that was as much anti-Arsenal as it was pro-Barcelona. I think it could have been anyone. But that's leaving my conspiracy theories to one side. We have some issues with discipline and indiscipline and red cards. And, you know, we've had 5 red cards in the Premier League this season. They've come in 4 games. Obviously, 2 of them were the other night against Wolves. In those 4 games, Arsenal have taken 2 points. So, you know, that's a lot of points dropped, particularly when you look at the Wolves game and you think if that goes in 11 versus 11, Arsenal 1-0 up at halftime, they build on that. I think we win that game. We go on, you know, Burnley, Granit Xhaka, the incident there, you know. It is a big issue for Mikel Arteta to sort out. Yet at the same time, I don't see this as a particularly dirty or cynical Arsenal team. The Pepe one was stupid. The Xhaka one was stupid. But I think the rest have been kind of, not necessarily dirty. There have been some situations that we've gotten ourselves into defensively, which have contributed to those. So how does he get on top of this? Because it is a feature of his reign. You know, you could say if he's had 2 or 3 yellow cards, it could be, you know, it's a peripheral issue. When you've had 9 in a year, basically, you've got a problem that you need to sort out.
You do, and he kind of admitted that today. It's mad to think in that space that they've got 9, that's 6 more than any other Premier League club. I mean, that's staggering, absolutely staggering statistic. But you look back at those 9, I can't think of one bad tackle in any of those.
Maybe
really.
Aubameyang against Palace, but even that was
Aubameyang one against Palace,
a bit late.
Absolutely.
That was the only one I can think of.
But then you've seen those ones time and time again since then go to VAR and not get sent off, players not get sent off. So when it's all freeze frame like that, because I was there at Palace that game, and at the time you didn't think it was a bad tackle at all. It was just he was a little bit late, obviously. And it does feel like they are a little bit hard done, mate. You've got to remember, Smith Rowe got sent off as well, and luckily that one got overturned as well. So you'd have another one. And again, that was for a nothing tackle, which kind of you see week in, week out. I mean, Bruno against Arsenal the other day for Man United. And feel like they are being singled out a little bit, I think, that some of the decisions are certainly going against them. But I agree, it's not some big conspiracy theory that the referees aren't getting together and deciding we're going to do Arsenal over. It's not like that. But it just seems to be like you said, if there is just this feeling in referee's head that they are slightly easier targets to punish than others, and that's what's happening. But they do have to sort it out, because like you said, you'd think of what the league table might look like if they hadn't had these red cards this season. They absolutely would have won on Tuesday night. They would have beaten Burnley. That for 10 minutes after half time, just before Jack got sent off, they were all over Burnley. The goal was coming. You could sense it was coming, and they were going to win that game. They ended up losing. Even Leeds, I think, although Leeds were playing really well, Arsenal had kind of, they got themselves into that game, and I really fancied them in the last half an hour at Elland Road. They even nearly won it without Pepe when Saka went through. And so they've absolutely chucked points away because of it. And so he does need to sort it out. He needs to... How you do it, though, when a lot of the things aren't, it's not like they're flying in two-footed, or yes, you can cut out the Xhaka and the Pepe ones and you can say, look, you absolutely can't do that again, fine and whatever, and drum it into the squad that you can't do that again. But in terms of some of the other ones, I suppose one of the ways is not starting David Luiz.
I was just going to ask you.
Because when I think he's been culpable for a third of the red cards, and they all seem to be the exact same ones as well. That is one way of drastically reducing your red card count, is not David Luiz.
That was my next question. It's here, David Luiz, and there's an appeal, and Mikel Arteta was confident that the appeal might be successful, but then you've got to ask, well, can you take the risk of playing him? Because I think, look, I'm not one to defend David Luiz's defensive missteps. I think in part the reason he got sent off against Wolves was because he pushed up too high up the pitch when he could have just dropped off and let the guy come at him. But I think he was unlucky to be sent off for the no challenge, really. You know, it was just an accidental collision, and I do think he was unlucky there. However, you cannot ignore the fact that he has had 3 red cards. You can't ignore the fact that he gave away a record number of penalties last season as an Arsenal player. So he is he's high risk. You know, he's a high-risk player. Like, when he's good, he's good. And the stories about him on the training ground and, you know, what a good influence he is around, particularly for the young players, I think they all like him and respect him as a footballer, and he gives them lots of time and all those things, which is great. But when you've got a track record like he has, it's a big risk for a manager to put him in. Like, if I were Mikel Arteta, as much as Arteta defends Luiz and talks up the positives about him, as he does with most of his players, in fairness, I'd be shitting it, picking him, because you just do not know when the bomb is going to go off. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I think he was very unlucky on Tuesday night. I agree. I'm not absolving him of all blame, because there's no way he could have gone bombing forward and left his position the way he did in the last seconds of the first half. You just stick next to Rob Holding, make sure you're not leaving any gaps, and wait for the referee to blow the whistle. Why he decided to go legging it off and chasing the ball, I have no idea. So he's certainly to blame for getting himself in that position. But it's never a red card. I don't know how you can get sent off for the other player kicking you when you're running and making no attempt to challenge for the ball. I just think that's incredibly harsh. And in defence of Mikel as well, I don't think ideally at the start of the season he would have been sitting there now thinking he was going to be playing David Luiz in January. I think the reason he's playing at the moment is that Gabriel had suddenly, who played so well at the start of the season, had injury issues. He then got COVID. He came back. He looked very shaky. Like, I wouldn't have been confident playing Gabriel after his performance in the FA Cup against Southampton. I thought he looked all over the shop. So, and he started to look a little bit shaky before he got the injury as well. So I can understand he's maybe having a little bit of a breather after that good 3 months. And then Mari was in the team and playing really well with Holding. Then Mari got the injury. So Luiz has kind of come back in because of others that had to drop out. And then, to be fair to him, he's been playing really well. He's man of the match against United. So he was always going to start at Wolves, I think. And he's just, he's kind of like Granit Xhaka in a way. You can't get rid of him. He keeps coming back into the team. You think that's the end of it. And then suddenly he's back in the team and playing well again. And he's kind of deserving of his place in the team, just like Xhaka at the moment, who I think is playing the best football he's almost ever played at Arsenal. And but I think this will be the last few months we see Luiz, obviously out of contract in the summer.
You don't see an extension?
I wouldn't totally rule it out, because I know how much Mikel likes him, and I know how popular he is, and how much the young players like him, and how much of a role model he is. So I wouldn't totally rule it out, but I kind of feel like Arsenal wouldn't give him another 2 years, and at his age he'll be looking for a 2-year deal somewhere. I can see him ending up back at Benfica next season, kind of seeing out his playing days over there. So I would be surprised if he signs a new Arsenal contract. But yeah, in terms of him at the moment and making mistakes, he's back in the team, but I do kind of feel like that's mainly because of injuries and selection issues that he suddenly turned up back in the team again.
All right. No, I do agree with that. I think we had started to see the move away from him. He went through a period where he didn't play a great deal. It'll be very interesting to see if he is available for the game against Villa, if he plays or not.
I can't see they're going to win that appeal. I was actually looking at my phone then, because you reminded me. I think we were supposed to hear fairly soon. We haven't had a message yet about it, but I'd be very surprised, because the FA would basically be then admitting that the referee's wrong and VAR is wrong. I just can't. It feels like one that Arsenal aren't going to win.
They can't reduce the ban anyway. It's only one game, So, okay. Well, look, I mean, that might say Mikel Arteta a decision and the rest of us some nails as we bite them when we face Villa on Saturday. We'll keep fingers crossed for that one. Charles, as ever, great to talk to you. Thanks a million.
Thanks a lot, mate. Speak to you soon.
All right, well, we're literally just 30 seconds after we finished that recording and saying goodbye, the judgment has come in on David Luiz, Charles.
Yes, it has, and the red card will stand. So it means he will be suspended. I'm just opening it up to see if Arsenal actually written any sort of statement. Just says, we have worked really hard to overturn David Luiz's red card. We presented our case to the FA, but disappointed that our appeal has been unsuccessful. We accept the FA's decision and continue our preparations for Saturday's match against Villa.
Okay.
Like I said, it felt like a difficult one for them to win, just because the FA were basically going to be admitting not just one, but a couple of officials got it wrong. So I'm not surprised.
No, well, they're not exactly well known for holding their hands up and admitting they got things wrong. So, all right. All right. This is goodbye again. Thank you, Charles.
Thanks, mate.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Thank you very much indeed to Charles. You can find him on Twitter. He is at Charles underscore Watts, at Charles underscore Watts. And of course, he does his writing about Arsenal for goal.com. Just mentioned David Luiz there. And look, the appeal was unsuccessful, so he won't be available for Arsenal. And we, I think, however you want to look at it, can understand why that decision was made. However, in that context, it's a bit difficult to understand why the red card appeal for from Southampton, for the red card given to Jan Bednarek for his sending off against Manchester United the other night, their appeal was successful. Pretty much the same incident in the sense that it was, you know, denying a goal-scoring opportunity. They've obviously looked at the videos of the two incidents and seen things that we cannot see with our mere mortal eyes, our non-FA eyes. They have seen a difference. I'd love for them to explain it. I don't hold out much hope that they will, but nevertheless, we have to get on with it. We have to deal with the absence of David Luiz for the trip to Aston Villa. And like I said on the Arsecast Extra on Wednesday after the Wolves game, if I'm Mikel Arteta and his coaching staff, I'm absolutely using what happened against Wolves to sort of foster a not quite a siege mentality, but you know what I mean? Something along those lines. They feel, and certainly some of the players made it obvious that they felt the decision to send their teammate off was the wrong one, or certainly harsh. So if they feel that way and they were frustrated enough to make it clear on their social media channels, I'm pretty sure they're going to be frustrated by the decision not to uphold the appeal. So Mikel Arteta has got plenty to work on and plenty to work with for a trip to Villa. It is going to be a very difficult game. As we know, they're a good side. They've got good players. They've hurt us. They've beaten us so far this season. But as a way of fostering a kind of togetherness in the squad and unity and a fighting spirit and all of those intangible things that, you know, don't come in any coaching manuals per se, or you can't measure them. But that's certainly something that I will be working on if I were Mikel Arteta. There are other reasons why this game will be won. If Arsenal can win it, the individual performances, the collective performance, the tactics, all of those things are far more important. But if you can add a little extra 1 or 2% by getting everyone together and giving a kind of, you know, a really good uplifting kind of team talk.
The inches we need are everywhere around us.
We don't need inches, but you know what I mean. So if it's something that he can use to get more out of his players, to inspire them, to just give that little bit extra that might get us the points at Aston Villa, then absolutely 100% use it. Use every bit at your disposal to get the maximum out of your team. And hopefully we can respond to the midweek disappointment and hopefully take all 3 points. For more on the Villa game, more previewing of the opposition and the rest, you can join us on Patreon. We'll have a Patreon podcast today. Friday, we will have a preview podcast for Patreon members. You can sign up if you like, patreon.com/arseblog. James and I will be here on Monday with an Arsecast Extra. Hopefully, we're talking about an Arsenal win. Hopefully, it's a goodly morning. So please join us for that. In the meantime, have yourselves a great weekend. I'll catch you on the next one. Until then, cheers. Bye-bye.
is a red card for David Luiz.
Then put your little hand in mine. There ain't no yellow
mouth. This is a red card for David Luiz.
Then put your
It's a red card for David Luiz.
Then put your little hand in mine.
This is a red card for David Luiz.
Then put your little hand in mine. There ain't no yellow mouth.
This is a red card for David Luiz.
Then put your little hand in mine. There ain't no yellow mountain we can't climb.
It's a red card for David Luiz.
Then put your little hand in mine.
It's a red card for David Luiz.
Then put your little hand in mine. There ain't no yellow mouth.
It's a red card for David Luiz.
Then put your little hand in mine. There ain't no yellow mountain we can't climb.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.